I've checked the text, and this is called obnoxious aggression.
Welcome back, everybody, to the next episode of Continuous Delivery Officers, where we delve into the topic of modern software delivery. I am your host, Tony Kelly, joined by our regulars, Mr. Bob Walker and Mr. Steve Fenton. The topic this week is haute couture, which is a play on haute couture, which refers to exclusive custom-fitting fashion design, but in our case, with haute couture is high-performing organization culture. We're going to look broadly at it today, but we will dive deeper into some of the specifics in future episodes. And this question is as much for me as the audience, Steve. We should start with a view on what is organizational culture? What are we talking about here? And I suppose, what is culture and who decides what it is?
Yeah, so I'm going to pause just for a second to say that when Bob raised his cup up just before we started and there was this wonderful picture of a dog on it, I've completely collapsed.
That's my dog.
That shows our culture.
We love our dogs.
Yeah, we'll get there. It's okay. Yeah. We're professionals. We can do this.
You have a pretty low bar of what a professional is there, Tom.
Yeah, so culture refers to how you interact within your company, how you collaborate. You can design culture to some extent, but very often your design for culture is going to be undermined by things that you do every day. So you can say, we're a great company. Everyone here is like family. But then when someone gets something wrong, you kind of come down on them like a ton of bricks and you keep on bringing it up that they made a mistake. Or if someone says, I'm not sure we should release this version because there's like a major problem in here, you're like, you get angry at them because they're bringing you a problem and you don't like it. Or you kind of make it their problem. It's like, don't bring me problems, bring me solutions. So quite often there's the culture that we would like to have, but what we're doing every day is really what makes the culture happen.
Yeah. And it's funny because it's the culture. I know that like a lot of the times, like the leaders, they're the ones that typically go, this is the culture that we want. And there's always the, well, we're going to post it somewhere. I once worked at a company where you'd walk into a building and there was a big culture statement right at the very top. Like it's the very first thing every employee saw. There was an employee entrance. That's what they saw. And then in other places, I worked at a company where you'd walk into another building to walk into, and they have a special room with five pillars. And on the pillars were the five key things that we wanted for the culture. And oftentimes they're very aspirational. A lot of the terms that are very, like, hey, helping each other out, bias for action, those types of things. And when you see it, you're like, oh, this is pretty cool. But then back to your point, Steve, is when you then see these kind of all these little interactions throughout the day, then you end up in a situation where it's like you're kind of subverting that culture. And then eventually when you walk in and you see that this big like statement or this big bold grandeur thing, you start eye rolling a little bit as like, oh yeah, it would be nice if we had something like that. But you know, what's funny is like, I mean, and every company has this, like, for example, I don't say every company has like the eye rolls or anything like that. It's more along the lines of every company has, hey, we want to define what our culture is. You want to let people know what are your key values, honestly. And that's why you see this throughout, you know, all these different companies. They all find different ways to do it. Being a remote first company, we don't have buildings that you can walk into where you could post things on pillars or on the wall or anything along those lines. So we have our handbook. And so right on Front Street, if you go to handbook.octopus.com, you can see what our culture and our values are. We have, you know, five key things, that including like bias for action, helping each other out, listening to our customers, doing a small number of things at a high quality, and I'm forgetting the fifth one because I don't have it up right now, but I was impressed I remember the four. But it's always having these types of things where, you know, this is the thing that always wants to anchor us back down. And so really the key is how can you scale that culture up and not have that subversion happen where you end up with the eye rolls over and over again. It's like, yeah, you say you want this thing, but let's be honest, that's not how it works.
There's a real good example of that. You kind of described my situation as well, Bob, where I've worked in orgs where like there's the things on the wall and like they stay on the wall. Nobody really cares what they are. But there's definitely been times at Octopus where I think, Steve, you might have been in this conversation where it was like, we're trying to do 20 things at once. And we kind of, I think when you can look at your values and you can say, actually, we can use our values here to make a decision. If we look at it and we say, hey, we should be doing a small number of things and do them really well. I'm paraphrasing what the value is, but it's in around those lines. Well, then doing 20 things at once isn't in line with that value. So we need to fix that. We need to change it. We need to get that 20 down to hopefully one, but maybe two. And I think that's where you can sort of start to see real, I suppose, culture build around those values. If you can actually look at them and say, yeah, we're doing it. I just used that. We talked about that yesterday. It helped me solve this problem that wasn't going with what we are, rather than maybe somebody jumping in and saying, no, you must do the 20 things. Them things really are just on the wall.
I think that's probably the big sign that the culture on paper is the one in reality, is when you're actually using it to make those decisions. So I think that's a really great example. I worked at an insurance company who had major quality problems. So they did posters, pens, mouse mats, signs up in the toilets, doing this campaign called RON. Do it right, do it once, do it now. And you know what happened to quality? Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
You know, it is funny because I love Tonio's example. Back to Tonio's example, where we actually even have Slack emojis that we've built, that our design team actually built with these icons that said, hey, we're going to have a, say, for example, my favorite one is bias for action. I am very much I don't like discussing things till the end of time. I'm very much I'd rather let's get something, let's do something, go left, go right, don't care. Let's just pick a direction, go with it. If it doesn't work, okay, we'll adjust, rather than let's try to have a plan to plan to plan to plan type of stuff. So we'll even have that in our Slack. And so you'll say, hey, I'm going to have a bit of a bias for action, or, hey, I want to help, you know, we're going to help each other out, those types of things, or, hey, we're going to do a small number of things. And so being very, very cognizant of that, I think is very huge.
What elements of that can we take care of as part of an intentional culture design? What does that look like in reality?
So for me, the big moment for me was when I read a really old book by, I think it's Doug McGregor, called The Human Side of Enterprise. And he basically pokes holes in the generally accepted view of motivation and what humans want to do with their life, right? And instead of this prevalent idea of people needing to be whipped into shape because they don't want to do work, Doug McGregor says, actually, people want to do a good job. They go home feeling better when they feel they've done good work. So it's completely flips it on its head. The other interesting thing is Ron Westrum did some really great work on information flow. He gave names to different culture types. So generative culture is the one that we all should be aiming for, which is where information flows really well, and where, you know, people are encouraged to share information so messengers don't get shot, versus bureaucratic or pathological cultures where information kind of doesn't flow as much as it should. So there's kind of cool stuff that you can go and read to get really deep into this stuff. But that detail of this stuff being the result of micro interactions, right? That's where the culture really happens. So you need to internalize those concepts so that when someone comes to you and goes, there's a major problem, you're like, thank you for bringing this to my attention. Because the information flow is so important to us being a healthy organization that you telling me is the first step to us not making a huge mistake here.
Yeah, I mean, being very intentional with that. I think information flow, I love that phrase. Honestly, up until literally 30 seconds ago when you started talking about it, I was aware of it, but I hadn't used that particular phrase. And I love that because it very much it signifies whether or not a culture that you're walking into is going to be a good culture or it's going to be a bad culture. And there are key signs when something's not working correctly, specifically when it comes around, say, information flow. For example, I worked at a particular company. I'm not going to name names or even the industry because you'll be able to figure it out pretty quickly. But they were obsessed with deadlines. Like, you had to hit these arbitrary deadlines. Why do you have to hit these arbitrary deadlines? Because someone a level above them said, we're going to be able to hit this deadline. And the level above them said, we're going to hit this deadline. And then eventually float up to the senior vice president made a promise to the president that we're going to hit this particular deadline on this particular date. And he doesn't want to look bad. And so hitting that deadline came above everything else. Now, there are good deadlines to have And there, I think there are bad deadlines to have. There are good deadlines where, hey, we're going to a conference. I have to give a talk, or we have to be at the booth. Those are deadlines that, like, no matter what, you can't move them, and you need to be aware of them. And you can plan, but you can plan way in advance of whether or not that's going to happen. For example, I worked at a company that provided election software. Well, a deadline was, well, we need to be ready to go with the final thing in production. I think it was like 3 weeks before the general election occurred. That's a good deadline because you can have a very material real world impact. You can see it. But then there are the arbitrary deadlines, the ones that someone just pulled out of a hat that said, we're going to hit it by this particular date. Why? Because I said so, that type of thing. So let's go back to the company with the deadline. This is a long winding story, but it gets to a point where, because of this arbitrary deadline, if you ever came up to a person or if I ever came to my boss and said, hey, there's a bug in the software that's going to prevent us from meeting this deadline. Well, it was you know what? You're going to have to stay here and fix this bug. And you're going to have to stay here, if necessary, all night to fix this bug, because we have to hit this deadline no matter what. And so that happens once or twice. And think about that impact that it has on the culture. Then people are afraid to bring that to their leaders or to their boss's boss, saying, hey, there's a problem. There's a big problem. Well, if they get their head bit off or they have to stay all night, they're not going to want to do that. It's going to create this, I want to say a culture of fear, but a culture of reprisal. And it's not really a harsh reprisal. It's just a reprisal. Like, I don't really like doing this. I don't want to share any more information. And so it comes back to that information flow, where you end up in a situation where there's like no information flow. And so people that are close to the ground, they know there are clear problems, but they don't want to share that with anybody because they're like, well, if I do share it, it's going to end up a terrible thing.
It's really interesting. And there's a really interesting balance somewhere in there where, the role of giving, I suppose, honest feedback to an employee per se, and then the conflict that it could create is that, well, if we do that a month down the line, will that person then not tell me the thing, or will they hide that information? And there's probably something to double click in there, and probably the foundation of culture where we can give that honest feedback, but still have the sort of culture where somebody would be like, okay, cool. Yeah, that was a good thing that we talked about that problem. And they'll continue to talk about it rather than shy away from it.
I think it definitely comes back to separating the message from the messenger. I think that's a huge part of it. The person that's sharing the information, hey, we're not going to be able to ship it because of this bug. It's if you have this reprisal against them right away, they're like, well, you snap back at them. Like, I can't believe we're going to miss our deadline or something like that. Then they're not going to want to do that. But if you separate it out and say, okay, this is the message that you're giving me. All right, let's address this particular problem. Let's work the problem as a team. Okay, then people are going to be much more willing to say, you know, tell you about it or anything along those lines. And if there are critical bugs in the system and you let that just go out, that's, you know, a clear problem later down the line. It's like you're just kicking the can down the road. And so I think that's a huge part of it as well. So it's always a difficult thing because, you know, oftentimes people don't want to hear bad news, but it's how the people handle the bad news, I think, is probably a clear indication of the culture, where it's just like, okay, all right, well, we got this. We're going to move on with our day. Again, I worked at a company where I accidentally brought down production, and I mean all of production, with my application, because we crashed a production SQL server. And this was an example of good culture, because like there was the question of, okay, what happened and why did it happen? Those are reasonable questions to ask someone. And then it was, well, I was just very honest. This is what happened. This is why it happened. This is what we're doing to address it in the future. We were also to turn it around and tell a bit of a success story. It's like where we were able, with our monitoring that we recently put in place, we were able to detect this problem. And we started working on the problem pretty quickly, but we didn't see what was going to happen, that it was actually going to cause production to go down. We were just like, oh my gosh, this is not a good thing. We're seeing all these problems. And then eventually it kind of cascaded, but we had started seeing this problem. So it was a case of, well, the monitoring alerted us, so it did its job. We're able to fix the issue. And so again, it was this kind of almost a blameless retro. Okay, this happened. Why did this happen? Anything along those lines.
I think that's really interesting, because the questions are like, how did this happen? Why did this happen? The question wasn't who did this. I think that's one of the crucial distinctions. We're not saying here that you can't give people good, clear, direct feedback. Probably not in response to them bringing you information, but when you need to give people feedback, at Octopus, when you join, you get given Radical Candor, which is a great book that kind of says you can kind of stay in this zone where you're nice and direct, everything's really clear, but you're not being nasty to people, but you're also not being ruinously empathetic and hiding feedback from people because you're worried about upsetting them. And for me, that was the zone that I'm most risk of going into. I'm like, I don't want to upset people, so I don't want to say, oh, I don't like what you've done. So yeah, having a framework for giving high quality feedback is super useful, especially if you err towards the, you know, being nasty about it or being too nice about it. It's like, find the middle. I worked with a couple of people who are really good at this. I'm going to call them Dominic and Paul, because that's their real names. But they had a way of, I was working on an integration, which was through a service. And they had a way of coming over to kind of see how I was getting on, and I'd show them my work. And they'd just say something like, wouldn't it be really cool if this service didn't actually need its own database, right? And I'd be like, oh, I don't understand how I could do this without a database. And I'd have a think about it. And then I'd go, oh, no, okay, yeah, I've got an idea. And I'd kind of do that and show it. And they'd go, yeah, that's cool. And then I'd go, wouldn't it be cool if... And they'd like give me the next suggestion. And because they were interested in what I was doing, genuinely curious about how I'd implemented it, they were able to just suggest in these really high quality improvements. Like when I finished writing that piece of code, I was super proud of it because it did all these things that I hadn't have thought to do myself, but I'd managed to kind of hit all of those bar raising exercises. And the feedback was about the work. So no one went, God, have you never done one of these before? Like, don't you know what you're doing? It was, wouldn't it be nice if the service did these additional things? Wouldn't it be nice if that function wasn't 20 lines? Could it be half that, you know, and just gradually steering me towards a really good outcome? So yeah, I think the feedback should be building the person up, building their skills up, rather than tearing them down.
Yeah, it's funny. My wife always said it, a skill that she really likes to use, she was a teacher for almost 12 years, is the compliment sandwich. Because when you're teaching kids, you have to make sure you build them up so they learn. You don't want to just constantly tear them down, because they're always wrong, because they're kids. They're just learning. And it's the same thing when you're writing code. You're still learning oftentimes about certain things. This isn't going to work. And so it was very much a case of, this is what I like about what you've done. This is like, let's say a piece of code. This is what I like about it. I think it's looking really good. It's accomplishing this. That's a really interesting design. Any number of different things. But be genuine about it. Don't just be, you know, superfluous. I should give them like real meaningful feedback. I like this because of this. And then you could say, but I am concerned about this, and here's the reason why. Or to your point, have you thought about this? I'm concerned about this. Have you thought about this? Maybe thinking about this. And then you kind of come back to, but I do like where you're heading with it, you know? So you kind of give them, and again, the key is you have to be genuine. You can't just be a robot. I just think of the Bill Lumberg of the world with Office Space coming up with just the, hey, Peter, how's it going? He doesn't care what he responds with. It's so just, you know, it's just such a transactional and personal interaction, let's be honest. But I think that's such a huge thing about it, is really focusing on the work that's being produced rather than the person. Kind of comes back to the message, you know, don't shoot the messenger, be upset about the message, but the messenger, they're just telling you what's what, and you can't be upset about that. It's, you just have to work and focus on the problem or focus on the task and the work, not the person itself.
Yeah, 100%. I think I can remember in my career some of the people who would start off the conversation with how's it going, and you wouldn't actually be able to respond before they started the ask.
Yeah.
Because they genuinely weren't interested, right? How's it going? I was just looking at this project.
This is everything you've done wrong up until this point, you know. You know, it's funny. I worked at a place, and I was promoted to be a lead developer. And right before I was the lead developer, the previous lead developer, two or three lead developers before me. The last one was actually awesome. But the one like before him, he would go around and he would write notes, like post-it notes, and put it on each developer's monitor as to where they screwed up the day before. I mean, that's honest feedback, but that's a terrible approach to doing it. So there's direct feedback. And it's also, it was about the work. It wasn't about the person. It was about the work. But at the same time, there is a human approach you can take with that. That's such a terrible thing to do. Could you, I mean, like, I don't know what, I probably would have melted down if I saw that happen.
Yeah. I've checked the text, and this is called obnoxious aggression.
Yes.
which we try not to, like, one of the things about radical candor is that you're not supposed to tell people which kind of feedback they give, because that in itself is a bad way of giving feedback. So, like, I'd never say, Tony, your style of feedback is obnoxious aggression. That's definitely not the right way of doing it. the irony of having these labels. But yeah, I think sticking post-it notes on people's screens is bypassing the human conversation. And like, right, when I think of Dominic and Paul, the way they gave feedback, there was always the possibility that they were wrong in how they were giving it. It was like, hey, it would be cool if it didn't need a database. Would that be possible? And it, I could have said, actually, I don't think it's possible in this case. You know, so that's a crucial part of it, is that someone giving feedback, I can be wrong. I may be wrong about, you know, your transaction's open too long. It's like, no, actually, these things all need to be part of the transaction. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Well, it comes back to like, hey, I have a concern about, and then they'll say, well, this is why this isn't a concern. I've thought through this X, Y, and Z. Okay, great. You know, I'm happy you thought about it. Don't have to think about it again. But as long as we kind of address this, but yeah. I also think of there's an episode in Silicon Valley where they bring up the book Radical Candor. I think it's when Richard is like interviewing like a COO, and he just is using radical candor as a way to just be a complete and total dirtbag throughout the entire episode. And so I love the book, but don't hide behind the book, if that makes sense. Don't say, well, you know, radical candor teaches this, that, or the other thing. That's such a, that's such a terrible thing to do. Don't do that. Don't be that guy. You know, be human with it. Take what it tells you, internalize it, and interpret it, and give it your own way. Don't just do it as a bespoke. Well, so radical candor does this, use it like a worksheet to make sure you check off each individual item. Like, don't be that guy. Come on.
There's a really good example, Bob, when you mentioned about incidents, and I've been involved in a few where we've taken the website down or broken something at Octopus. Steve, your face. but Kiel, who kind of runs some of our incidents, shout out to Kiel, just done such an amazing job. Like in a day or two afterwards, we would jump on and he would set the scene perfectly. And as you said, it's like a blameless process. We're just trying to work out the process. Where did things go wrong? And it's funny, even you see people, they're in it and they're like, they're starting to blame themselves. Like, oh, I did this. I can't believe I clicked that. And then this happened. And Kiel's like, let me stop you right there. It's like, you're not even allowed to blame yourself here. This is not you. you're not the problem. But it's like, why did it? Like, let's explore it. Why? And he was like, oh, I was just doing this. And I was like, were you following any guide? It's like, no, there is no guide. So problem one. It's kind of like you start to unpick the part. So it's just a really nice, empathetic way. And people were almost starting to close down as they were blaming themselves. And you could see them coming back out like, oh, okay, cool. I can talk openly about the thing here that went wrong. And it's not me. It's the process around it.
I do believe that you should take responsibility. Like, I was the one who pushed the button. I was the one who did the action. But there's a big gulf between taking responsibility and just be like, oh my gosh, I did everything wrong. Well, why did it comes back to the context? Well, why did you make that decision? That's one of the things I really enjoyed working here at Octopus, and this is why, really honestly, why I stick around for so long, is that when something goes wrong, for example, years and years and years ago, back when I was reporting to our CEO, I made a few mistakes, and what the mistakes are is unimportant, but then he came to me and he was just like, okay, I'd like to understand your thought process behind this. It was one time I had concerns about an email going out to our customer base. I raised them and it was kind of ignored. And then my boss, you know, the CEO said, well, why didn't you just stop that email from going out? Why didn't you say, hey, listen, as I'm saying we should not send this out. We need to pause. We need to have someone else take a look at this, review it. It's like, why didn't you do that? I was like, well, honestly, I didn't think I had, like, I didn't have all the context to make the appropriate decision and say, we need to stop this. It's like, no. My goal here is to give you the context. It's not to blame you because you let this happen. It was like, you just didn't have all the context to say that, yes, you do have the authority to block this type of thing from happening. So get back to your example around the, do you have the process in place to do this? Do you have the worksheet? Do you have the steps that you need to follow? The decision-making tree, whatever the case may be, do you have all the appropriate context? And I really internalized that. So when I was a manager, and I'm glad I'm not anymore, but when I was a manager, when someone would make a mistake, my job was really is like, I want to give you the extra context so you can see how I arrived at the decision that I arrived at versus the decision that you arrived at.
There's an apocryphal story about IBM and the numbers and exact scenario changes, but it goes along the lines of a developer made a mistake that cost $10,000. And they said to the boss, well, you're going to fire them. And he was like, I've just spent $10,000 giving them the best training about this. Why would I fire them now? Like, they will never do that again. If I fire them and hire someone else, they might. So yeah, I think that's it's interesting how companies who don't understand that mistakes come from a complete system are liable to make those mistakes. It's never an individual. It's an individual acting within a wider system that is filled with tripwires and rakes.
There was another company I worked for where a person made a really substantial mistake and they didn't fire him right away. But it was probably about 4 or 5 months later they fired him. And the reason they said, well, it's because he made that mistake. So I'm like, so you kept him around like he had a sword of Damocles hanging over his head for those 5 months? Like, because it's basically like, well, if you screw up one more time for any little reason, well, we're going to turn around and fire you. We're going to say this is the reason why. That sends such a terrible message across the board.
All right, Steve, I think we're there. Question of the week time. What do you got?
Yeah, so this is kind of therapy now because we're going to share a story. What is the most pathological culture you have worked within? So what was the most aggressive, horrible culture? And how long did you last? I've thought about this. There were a few competing for the trophy on this one. But I worked in this company where the CEO basically was using like an old psychological playbook to try and get his way on everything. Mm-hmm. So he would ask for something that just the laws of physics were not going to allow this thing to happen. And he would be told, the project manager would go, that's not going to be possible. And he would just stare at them until they broke and said, we'll see what we can do. Right. And the problem with that is this behavior started getting replicated by the next level down and the next level down of everyone copying this completely pathological playbook of staring people out and visibly being frustrated when you're not getting the information that you want. And I was brought in to help fix the development team, which is a common gig in companies like this. And I brought them into a room just for a catch up and to just see if we were going to be able to release the software because they had been making changes. And I said to the team, is the software releasable right now? So always an interesting test to see whether a team can answer that question. And the room was just silent because the company had basically educated everyone not to answer questions like that. So they knew it couldn't be deployed, but no one was going to say it out loud, even though they all knew, because they didn't want to be the one who said it.
Yeah, thinking it through, I would probably say I worked for a company. I lasted almost 2 years, just shy of 2 years, maybe right around there. And I, starting there, it was very much a boiler room at times. Where it's just kind of like a constant pressure that you have to deliver, blah, 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 blah. But I think the worst, honestly, was they had an on-call rotation that made no sense, where basically you were on, most on-call rotations I've been a part of up until that point, it's like you were on call like maybe once every 8 weeks, once a quarter, and it was for a week. And most of the time, like if you got paged, it was a pretty big deal. Like something clearly happened that you need to be notified and you need to be brought in. This on-call rotation, it was a week and it was once every 4 weeks. And you got paid. If you got a good night's sleep, it was a rare event because you were getting paged all the time. And so it's just kind of like, how do you succeed in that culture of just kind of like this constant firefighting mode? And that's all we would do is we would firefight over and over again. And honestly, the majority of the time, the pages that we would get were because of the same problems over and over again. And literally what I would have to do is I'd wake up, I would remote in, and I'd rerun. It was typically because a job failed. I rerun the job. That's literally all it was. And it typically it happened because a file wasn't in place and blah, 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 blah. But it was a constant game of firefighting. That's all it was. It's like, we have to firefight. We have to fix the, it's like, don't worry about it. All we're doing is you just have to keep the lights on for one more day. And you couldn't retroactive, like you couldn't go in and fix that particular issue. Why does this keep happening? Because you had these arbitrary deadlines that you had to meet. And so it was just this, it was just a terrible, terrible experience to have.
I think for me, it wasn't so much the place, but like the environment. So I done two and a bit years within an agency, and it's just entirely different to an in-house role. But there's huge benefits in terms of like you get more exposure to a range of industries, different projects, things like that. But there's just some things that come with it where it's like, you then need to do timesheets because that's how much we know we're going to bill the customer. So typically everyone would come to Friday and it's like, hey, what we need to get our timesheets on, do your timesheet. And it was like down to the 15 minute mark of what you've done. So like maybe the last half hour, 15 minutes on a Friday, everyone would do their timesheets. And then it would be like, oh, you'd put that on as your last 30 minutes of the week, sorting out timesheets, doing this. Then it was like, you can't do that. You can't spend time doing your timesheets. It's like, well, it's not straightforward. It's not like I'm doing the same thing Monday to Friday. You might have had 10 clients and it was 2 hours here, an hour, and you needed to get it right. Or a client would be like, well, why did you spend 3 days on that thing that should have taken an hour? So it took a little bit of working out. So that was the first sign. It was like, oh God. It's like, so everyone had this weird training on a Friday evening at 4:30, which was really timesheets. But then I think one of the final things was COVID came. And at this point, it was in the office Monday to Friday. That was just the way. It wasn't that big a deal. That's just the way it was. But COVID came. Everyone had to go remote. So it was a huge cultural shift that way. Everyone adapted really well. And then like within a week, it was like, okay, by 9:15 every morning, you have to have been on Slack and put a message in what you're working on today. I was like, but it's not to make sure you're online. It's just to make sure that you're working on the right thing. And everyone was like, And very quickly it got to like, what are you working on today? Same update as yesterday. What are you working on tomorrow? Same update as today. And it was just like, it turned so tragic, but it was just those little things where it was like, this is so pointless, but there's zero trust here.
It's funny to me that, because when COVID hit, you can definitely tell the companies that had good culture and the companies that had bad culture. And the, especially like I say 2021, right around when you saw that, like these hiring just binges, people would go out and people were changing jobs all over the place. Cause honestly, part of it was the pay was better. Cause you know, they had to stay up. But the other part of it, honestly, is probably they're like, okay, the culture was exposed quite substantially at this other company. And once we went remote, it was like all the little things that you kind of put up with in the office got amplified to 11. And you're like, I don't know what's going on here, but I don't want a part of this anymore. A company I previously worked for, I actually got to see what it looked like, what good looked like, which was, okay, we have to work from home. What we're going to do is, because everyone already had laptops. They always equipped all the employees with laptops. That was a given. They're like, well, we don't want employees to be hunched over their laptops all day. That's not a great experience. At least for all the developers, they all shipped them like 34-inch widescreen monitors and a keyboard and a mouse. They're all brand new equipment. They spent a significant amount of money. But like, listen, we're going to have to work from home for a while. let's make sure that you're comfortable. Let's make sure that we're doing this the right way, as opposed to just like, well, sucks to be you. Hopefully that table, hopefully the car table and the folding chair is going to work for you, you know? So yeah, it was very interesting when you saw COVID and the impact it had on culture like that.
Super. I think that wraps us up for the week. Thank you everybody for joining us as usual. I hope you learned something interesting and useful about organizational culture and its impact on software delivery. As always, if you enjoy this episode, you can find us on YouTube or your podcast provider of choice if you search for Continuous Delivery Officers. And again, we have a bunch of white papers, books, things like that over at octopus.com/publications, which are all closely related to the things that we chat about on the podcast. And yeah, happy deployments. See you in the next episode.